Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, cartographers Stenter Danielson and Andy Woodruff discuss map-making and telling stories with maps, moderated by map curator David Weimer. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the next program in this space at the American Writers Festival. My name is Annie Allman, and I'm the Administrative Associate at the American Writers Museum, and I'm excited to introduce our next program. We're going to spend the next installment of the festival exploring cartographic writing, the kind of writing that combines science, aesthetics, and technique to make maps that tell stories as well as giving directions. Belt Publishing's Cities in 50 Maps series feature words and images that drive a narrative sense of place, and we welcome two authors from that series, Stenter Danielson and Andy Woodruff, along with David Weimer, the Robert A. Holland Curator of Maps at the Newberry Library. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage.
Yeah, thank you all so much for coming. It's great to see so many map lovers here, and if you're not here for maps, you are now. So you may have wandered to the wrong place, but you found yourself in the right place. So I was trying to think of ways to describe maps in literary terms, since we're a little bit of the odd person out here. And I was coming up with, I came across a quotation in the General Drafting's Maps and Mapping book that they wrote on their 50th anniversary in 1959. And they talk about maps as just about the most functional of man's inventions. A good map wastes no space, wastes no time. It shows everything that is necessary, nothing that is unnecessary. And that struck me a lot like how Ernest Hemingway describes his writing in Death of the Afternoon, and he has the famous metaphor of the iceberg, and the dignity of movement of an iceberg is due to only 1/8 of it being above water. So there's a sense of maps, at least in the 20th and 21st century, really having this expert attention and detail going into you not noticing any of the details. So kind of like Beyonce's Flawless in that respect. So I'm really excited to have our two guests here today to talk about how they make maps, what they do with maps. I also want to encourage you that when you come out of here, even more enthusiastic about maps than you came, come to the Newberry. We have hundreds of thousands of maps from the 15th century to the present. There's also a vibrant map and geography community in Chicago. There's the Chicago Map Society that has meetings every month, and there's the Geographic Society of Illinois, or Geographic Society of Chicago, that has all sorts of other fun events like GeoTrivia. So with that introduction, I just want to ask both of you how you got into map making, kind of what brought you to this world.
For me, I'm Andy, by the way. I kind of was always into maps, like as a kid, riding in the back seat on the family vacation in the car, looking at the road atlas, looking where we're going, imagining what that place is going to be like, just by looking at the map, you know, reading atlases at home for fun, that kind of thing. And when I went to college and just decided what to study, I kind of went back and forth between some kind of hard sciences and geography, and I landed on the side of geography in a liberal arts education. I focused eventually more specifically on cartography in graduate school, a couple hours away in Madison, and kind of ever since then have been into maps, and that's what I've been doing ever since. So not a whole lot of a story, except just always maps.
So how I got into maps was Lord of the Rings. I read Lord of the Rings for the first time when I was actually in third grade, and just loved the map. You know, spent a lot of time flipping back to the map to see exactly where they were going and where are these different places, and that just kind of grew into an interest in maps and places, and then initially, I thought, because I love Lord of the Rings so much, I wanted to be an English major when I got to college. Then I discovered that you could major in geography. And I was like, that's even cooler. So I majored in geography, learned a lot more about maps, and that's become a big part of my professional career from there on.
Can you walk us through kind of the process of making a map? I think a lot of people have a general idea of you hit some buttons and something comes out, but kind of where do you start? What kind of different tools do you use? How much is digital versus analog? The whole kind of walk through the whole process.
Yeah, so there's a ton of different ways to make a map because, yeah, sometimes you're using digital tools, sometimes you're just hand drawing it with a pen, sometimes you're cutting out pieces of paper. You know, there's a lot of different techniques that you can use, but I think the important thing across all of those, whatever tools you're using, is knowing what it is you're trying to say with this map. You know, why are you making this map? What are you trying to understand for yourself? What are you trying to show to other people? And that will help you to decide things like, you know, what scale should this map be? Right? So like, you know, my book is Pittsburgh in 50 maps. Some of those maps are just the city limits of Pittsburgh. Some of those zoom in on one little neighborhood. I have some maps that are world maps, but it's showing, you know, something about Pittsburgh in the world context. Right? And to decide that, I decide, well, what is it that I'm really trying to say with this map? And then, you know, what kind of symbols do I put on the map? What sources of data do I need for this map? It's all sort of driven by thinking about what is it that I'm trying to tell people about the world by making this map.
Yeah, thank you. That's actually a really good point to consider. It's not just the technical process of making a map. It's these decisions that go into what the map is and what you're trying to show. I think there's probably a lot of people who imagine cartographer, someone making a map, and they still picture, you know, somebody from like the 16th century plotting the world. And, you know, some people are still out there, like, in the field doing that. For someone like me who does it day to day as a career, it's digital stuff. It's on computers. It can be code-driven. I mean, if you think of how you interact with a map now, it's most likely on your phone. You're using it probably every day. And there's tons and tons of people and code and all kinds of architecture behind that. So it could be programming, essentially. What I do is usually with GIS, which is Geographic Information Systems, for anybody who may not be familiar with that. That's kind of computer technologies for working with geospatial data, doing calculations on them, you know, working your data into something that matches what you're trying to show on your map, and then plotting it in a basic form as a map. For me, these days, I'm usually doing kind of printed maps. So that means taking it into graphic design software, essentially, and, you know, starting to make it look nice, make it look like what you want. Another route is just digital. I used to do a lot of interactive web-based cartography, so that, again, was more code. But trying to kind of turn that data into something that looks good, is usable, gets the message across, serves the purpose of the map. I don't know if that's a little vague, but yeah, it's like a mix of different tools along with the decision making behind it.
Yeah, and if I can tell a little story about one of my maps that I think might tie some of this together. So, you know, as I was making these maps, you know, I downloaded a whole bunch of data from different places and was sort of mapping it out, seeing if it was interesting, seeing what I wanted to do with it. And so one of the data sets that I had mapped out was the average housing age. This is something that's collected in the U.S. Census, so I downloaded the census data, and I had this, you know, by neighborhood, the sort of average age of houses there, and I mapped that out, and I was like, oh, this is interesting, you know, it kind of reflects what I was, you know, kind of knew about what areas of the city had like, a lot of redevelopment lately, which had all of the, like, fancy old houses, or all the, like, really run-down old houses, you know, that's mildly interesting, but, you know, I was thinking about this some more, I was like, but, you know, why would you really care about this, right? What is really important about knowing the age of these houses? And then it occurred to me, well, one of the issues if you have a really old house is you might have lead paint in it, right? And so that makes this matter more because that's a health hazard, especially if you have children. And so then I went looking and I found that all of the children in the schools throughout the county are tested for lead. And that data is published at the neighborhood level, And so I took that data and I put that into the map as well. And with the GIS programs, I could overlay those two, right? So I had a map of housing age and it was overlaid with a map of which neighborhoods that had children with elevated lead levels. And now you could really see the overlap there, right? The matchup that wherever there was really old houses, you also had lots of children with elevated lead levels. And now that map, you know, by using that capability that maps have and that the GIS software has to easily overlay that data, now I could tell you know, an even more important and interesting story about the risk that, you know, lead paint still poses to people in some areas of the city.
I selfishly am always interested in asking how people make their maps, because as a curator, I'm always trying to think about how do I archive the process of map making. And I love bringing out the mid-20th century drafts because they look more like collage. There's a lot of collaging that happens, and just kind of an example of how the process changes over time. But how you're talking about those data sets makes me wonder what the strangest place you've gone to look for a data set, or kind of what you think of as like the oddest data set you've come across. The example I always give to people is the city of Boston has a data set of all the trees in the city. And I use an example that don't try to preview it on your computer because it will crash your computer, because it's like, oh, preview, and then it tries to load like 80,000 trees, tree points into your browser, and then your computer says, I'd prefer not to. What do you think is, like, what's the strangest place you've ended up going in this kind of the story that the map has brought you along through?
Can I say I use that data set in my book? My book is Boston in 50 Maps. That's the area I live, hence my wrong socks shirt here. I also worked on maps for Cincinnati in 50 Maps. I have a map of those trees. I guess I got it to work somehow.
Well, but it works fine if you download it.
Oh, okay,
it does not work fine if you put it in your browser.
And the way I used that was to... Initially, I just had a map of trees. Sorry, this is kind of tangential, but I had a map of trees, and that was fine, I guess, to see where all the trees were. But then what I ended up doing was looking at the tree species of each one, or at least, you know, among the, like, most common 15 species or something in the city, and then coloring it by about what color it turns in the fall, because New England is well known for autumn foliage, and that just made it a more interesting story. I'm not sure what the strangest source, what am I thinking of? This is not really a strange data source, but also in Boston, there's a 311 system where you can report like civic requests to the city, so that's fine, but a bunch of what's in there is pretty interesting. People will report like all kinds of weird stuff, and somebody from the city has to respond to it in some way or another. It might just be closing the case. I've used a couple maps out of there. One of them is people reporting turkeys in Boston. This is a story. You know, turkeys are famously associated with mythological events in New England, think Thanksgiving. But they were actually like gone from Massachusetts in the 19th century, and they were reintroduced in maybe like the 1970s or so in the parts of the state, and they've just, over decades by now, they've made it into Boston and especially the suburbs, and people are still just not quite sure what to do with that. They see turkeys, some of them are quite mean and aggressive. So there's all kinds of just really interesting reports in there, and I didn't actually see what people reported, but I can see the responses, which a lot of times is, couldn't find turkey, case closed, or turkey flew away, it's fine, case closed. So maybe not a weird data source, but weird data in the source.
I'd like you to imagine right now that you're seeing that map here. It's not currently working, but it could be.
It's mostly a bunch of dots, but...
Yeah, so I've got two examples that I think were particularly interesting. So one is that I wanted to make a map of Pittsburgh's Chinatown. And the problem is that Pittsburgh no longer has a Chinatown, because the area that had been that neighborhood where there had been a lot of Chinese immigrants coming to in the early 20th century got basically bulldozed for a highway project. So even the streets and, you know, buildings that were part of it when it was Chinatown don't exist anymore. And so I had found some old maps that showed like the streets and even the buildings, and I was able to, you know, copy that out. But I wanted to label what they were. And I've been reading some, sources about it, people writing about this aspect of the city's history that were mentioning there were different like social clubs and grocery stores that served that community and stuff, like, you know, all the things that if you were there when it was Chinatown would make you recognize it as such. But a lot of these sources weren't giving like an address. They were just saying, you know, downtown there was the, you know, whatever social club. And so I ended up having to go into some scanned archives of old newspapers and find advertisements. And so like the Chinese grocery store would advertise and they would have their address in the advertisement. And then I could figure out, you know, which of these buildings on the map was, you know, this Chinese grocery store or whatever, in order to, you know, reconstruct a map of this place that has been, you know, lost to history. The other fun one was that I did a map of something that's called the Pittsburgh Left. So this is a sort of traffic pattern in Pittsburgh where we have a lot of, you know, it's not like Chicago where it's all flat and everything's in a grid. We have a lot of weird corners and narrow streets. And so there is a sort of a practice where if you are at a stoplight and it turns green and the person coming towards you is trying to make a left, you let them, the first person, go before you go straight. And so this is, you know, it's an informal thing. It is officially illegal according to the state of Pennsylvania, right? So nobody has like a database of where people make a Pittsburgh left because, you know, it's not like an official thing. So I found a database of all of the stoplights in the city. And I went to each one using like Google Street View and dropped down into the intersection and kind of looked around and just had to kind of decide, okay, if I was in a car here, would somebody be trying to make a Pittsburgh left in front of me? Right? Because if like if there was a designated turn lane, then, you know, you wouldn't need to let somebody go because they're going to get the arrow for themselves, right? Or if, you know, it's a one way, then nobody's going to be looking at you. So I had to just do that, like, one by one, every stoplight in the city, and go through and look at it on Street View, and then some of them I actually visited, like, you know, in person to check it out, to make my judgment about whether you could do this weird traffic thing at that particular corner.
I love that map, by the way, because it's also a classic Boston driving move to do that exact same left turn. So.
I think in Pittsburgh it might be a sign of generosity, in Boston it's a sign of aggressiveness. So I'm curious what your, like, how your relationship to these cities kind of influences, impacts how you make this. And I know that, you know, Sandra, you've done Pittsburgh, but now you're working on D.C. and maybe Philly, and Andy, you've done Cincinnati and Boston. You have different relationships with those places, and kind of what the process is for you when you're kind of closer or farther from this, and how you think about kind of toggling or thinking about both audiences that are local and very familiar with this place, but then also kind of tourists or people that just want to learn more about a place that they watched The Pit and now they want to learn about Pittsburgh. You know, the people that aren't there every day or maybe have never been there, but they are interested in seeing some maps about it.
Yeah, if I get to do a second edition, then I'll definitely add a map of, you know, locations featured in The Pit. into my book. Yeah, it is definitely different map depending on how well you know the city. So, you know, I've been living in Pittsburgh for almost 2 decades now, and so I was able to draw on a lot of that local knowledge, you know, to know what things are important to people that live in Pittsburgh, what things are going to make them have that little spark of recognition of like, oh yeah, that thing, I know about that thing when they see the map. And also what things that are things that I really want to share with people that I know that people don't know so much about. You know, I mentioned the Chinatown thing earlier. You know, I think most people in Pittsburgh don't even realize that the city used to have a Chinatown. Right? So there it's like I'm sharing a thing that I found out about our city that I want people to know more about. And, you know, it is a little different when I'm working on a city that I don't know as well. So as Dave mentioned, I'm doing the cartography for Washington, D.C. in 50 maps, but I'm working with a writer who lives in the city. And so she's able to provide some of that context. So, for example, one of the maps we're doing for that book is a map of the hardcore punk scene in D.C. So that's a big music scene. It's not something I know nothing about, but she knows all about it. She knew where all of like the clubs that you go to hear that, you know, particular music scene were, and was able to provide that information, and then I can translate it into a map.
Yeah, and I had the same process on a Cincinnati book. So I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. I'm like reasonably familiar with Cincinnati, but I'm not a local. Like, I don't know the music scene. I don't know the art scene. I know the general geography of the city. I know basic history about it. I've definitely looked at maps of it a lot, but that relied on a local author, a local expert to really drive the stories that we were telling and the story about each map. You know, I can make maps of anywhere, but I can't necessarily tell a story about a place meaningfully if I don't know the place in some personal way, I guess. Boston, I've lived in the Boston area now. I'm not from there, obviously, but I've lived there for some 18 years now, and I've spent a lot of time mapping it, and I've gotten to know it very well. So obviously I'm a lot closer to that, and starting on that project, as a Stentor's Pittsburgh book, you know, that was a solo author slash cartographer project. So I already had like a million ideas in my head, and I'd already made a bunch of maps of the city that I wanted to include in some way. And yeah, some of them are, yeah, trying to include the things that make local people proud of that place or things that they celebrate about it. And then, you know, it's a lot of what Stentor said. Also, you know, sharing things that maybe I know that people might not know. Also just, you know, some stories about history and whatever that just seem interesting. But also the things that outsiders know in Boston, be it history topics, especially, you know, the Revolutionary War stuff, that kind of thing. It seems worthy of including the things that make a city well known to outsiders. You know, especially if you're trying to sell books to more people, of course. And then, you know, also things like, I don't know, the sports teams. You know, everybody knows obnoxious Boston sports stuff. And so that's, the local people can love that map. The out-of-towners can hate that map. And that's great. And Dunkin' Donuts in Boston. You have a lot of them here, too. But they're ubiquitous out there.
How do you think about the, like, narrative arc of the 50-ish maps in the volumes? Like, how are you, were you thinking about a kind of larger story about the cities, or, yeah, how are you thinking about the kind of shape of the book as a whole?
It's interesting, because we discussed this topic the other day, and then I kind of regretted, like, having to answer it. But I think my processes have been, in part, it's been just a big list of maps that I want to make, and then figuring out how those kind of turn into a cohesive narrative, anything. But they do, sort of. It's not like one map flows into the next, but there's kind of these threads that tie a lot of them together when you're looking at maps, especially historical themes. You know, a map of something modern has its roots in something that happened 200 years ago, geographically, or the shape of what something was 200 years ago. In Boston, for example, the first map I have in the book is all the made land. A lot of Boston used to be like water and mud flats, and a lot of the land there that's in the center of the city was not land 200 years ago even. And then in subsequent maps later in the book that have nothing really to do with that, you can still kind of see that ghost of the old shoreline in the modern day pattern of some phenomenon. Like, obvious ones include coastal flooding risk. Like, if you look at the modeled flooding risk, you start to see that exact same landform appear again. Like, that's the area that's safe from flooding. There's a couple other things like that. But I think, yeah, there's sort of a history that ties everything together, I think, at least in the maps I've done.
Yeah, I think the through line that I was thinking about as I was doing my book is that people in Pittsburgh all care very deeply about the city. You know, it's a city where people will, among themselves, trash talk it all up and down. But as soon as an outsider says something bad about Pittsburgh, then, you know, how dare you? And people care about the city, and so they care about the good things and the bad things. You know, I have maps of, you know, things that are really cool and positive about the city. I have maps of, you know, a lot of the social, environmental, and other kind of problems that the city has, but those problems matter because people care about the city and want it to be better and want it to be better for everyone there. And so I was kind of thinking this is something that, you know, if somebody is in Pittsburgh, whether they're a visitor, whether they're lived there their whole life, they can put themselves into the map. Right? They can see the map. Oh, this is where on this map, you know, I live and I work and everything, where my friends are, and kind of connect that to what they're seeing in the map of whatever feature. And it helps them to understand the places that they're moving through on their day-to-day, week-to-week kind of life. They can connect it to these other stories about the city that may be things that they don't know very much about, aspects of the city that they hadn't stopped to think about, but now they can see, using the map, how that intersects with how they live in the city.
Are there, like, historic maps or illustrators, or how do you think about, like, what influences your, or things that you look to when you're making your maps or doing your work that you think of as influences or inspirations? Kind of what out there exists that funnels into your work that you encounter?
Got to think for a sec, I guess. There's so much. I mean, for me, I'm having trouble naming something. Stared at so many maps over time that there's just this whole collection of them. I do like sometimes emulating historic map styles, kind of from, I don't know what the era would be, maybe in like 19th century. You have to be careful with that because a lot of the maps from that time are kind of not used for good purposes. So, you know, you could end up just copying a style of a map that really was used for like colonizing and subjugating people, and it's not necessarily the best idea with every map to copy its style. But yeah, I've been influenced in trying to figure out modern ways of doing some styles like that. But I don't know, I think a lot of my influences are really like colleagues and peers out there right now that are doing really amazing, beautiful maps. And I see them all the time and I think, ooh, I shouldn't say steal, but I want to use those colors on a map of mine. And yeah, like try to make it look more like this map that Sarah Bell did, or, you know, whoever. You probably don't know all these people, but all these cartographers that I interact with in my circles have been really inspiring to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say mostly the same thing. But I'll say it's also nice to be part of this series, you know, that there's how many, like, 7 or 8 books in the 50 Maps series that are out thus far, and we've got several more coming. There's a Chicago in 50 Maps that they told us coming out sometime next spring. So, you know, all of you Chicago folks can look forward to that. And just the community of us working on these maps together is also an inspiration. Like, the first thing that I did when I signed the contract, so I learned about this series because I came across the Buffalo in 50 Maps book, and I actually interviewed the author / cartographer of that one, Vicki Johnson Dahl, for a podcast that I was doing, and was talking to her about it. And so then, you know, that book, as well as, what was it, Detroit and Cleveland, were also out at that time. Just looking through those books was an inspiration, and seeing what other people working on our same series were doing. And then, you know, so I did Pittsburgh, and then a few more have come out, and now as I'm working on the Washington, D.C. one, I'm also reading all of the other ones that come out, you know, Boston that just came out, and Columbus and Cincinnati, and taking more inspiration from them, so that the book, each book that we do, has its own distinctive personality, because each city has its own distinctive personality, but is also, you know, part of a thing with the previous books in the series.
That's true, and I also just want to put in a plug for cartographers, like practicing professional cartographers. It's a kind of a small world, as you might imagine, and it's a very, very good community of people who are always willing to share their work just to help inspire others and, you know, help them along. Also, and you know, the series of maps, I did the same thing, of course. The first thing I did was read through the existing books. There were, at my time, 4, including Pittsburgh, when I started. And every time the series grows, as it is, there's several, I don't know how many more cities are in the pipeline now, but we've gotten several group emails from the editor of these books saying, here's the new cartographers, everybody talk amongst yourselves, and we do a little bit. And so it is very nice, yeah, being part of it, of a series that's for these books specifically.
Reminds me, too, of one thing you mentioned, we talked earlier, which was sometimes people being surprised that there are cartographers that are alive and making maps. And that reminds me of this, like, I get these, I get it from all ages, actually, like two totally like opposed complaints about maps, which is on the one hand, I get people saying, sometimes it's the same people, complaining that young folks or fellow young folks don't know how to get around anymore. The implication is that they're just relying on their phone, i.e. the map on their phone, to get them everywhere, and they're not looking around, they're not thinking for themselves. That same person might also then complain to me that no one uses maps anymore. And by that, maps, they mean paper maps, right? That there aren't any maps anywhere anymore. That's where I think the idea of there's no map makers out there anymore. And that, I think, speaks to kind of, one, how people think about maps, which is in the current moment, which is that they're just kind of this set of facts that are on your phone, that there's no map maker that went to that. But also that how we relate to and how we use maps is kind of changing, has been changing pretty rapidly in the last 20 years, and some 30 years. And so I'm curious how you both think about how the relationship people have with maps is changing and evolving, and kind of how that shows up in your work.
I can say something because as my Boston book has very recently come out, I've been doing some little media interviews and stuff. And so I've been working on this talking point that is something like, right now, like in this moment, more people are using maps than ever before, more people are making maps than ever before. And that's surprising because people aren't thinking of that thing on their phone as a map that people made. And it definitely is. And even though it seems like this set of facts, we usually caution in cartography, there's really no such thing as a totally factual map. Somebody's decisions went into it about what to show, how to show it, who to show it to, things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's like, it's a golden age of maps. It's just that it's all on your phone. And there's all kinds of really cool stuff happening in, you know, innovative things happening with maps. I am, of course, nostalgic for paper maps. I've, you know, got my box of them in the basement that I have to keep for some reason, even though I'll never use them. But I like to look at them. There's a type of artistry that went into them that you don't usually see on digital maps anymore. And I don't know. So there's only a couple Amazon reviews for this Boston book so far, but one of them is something like, this is not a street map of Boston, so it doesn't work for getting around. there's like a pretty detailed description with like images from the book on there, but this person was expecting a street map, so it's like, huh, but also like, that's great, someone's looking for a paper map of Boston still, like, that's cool, and they liked it enough to still leave 3 stars, so even if it didn't work, I was pretty pleased with that, I'll take it. So I don't know if that's much of an answer, but that's what I've got.
Yeah, I get my best 3-star review was someone said that I was pushing a woke climate change LGBTQ agenda, but they still gave me 3 stars. So yeah, I was like, thank you. I guess to get to 5 stars, I need to be more woke next time. But yeah, and you know, my day job, I'm a geography professor, and you know, the thing that I'm always trying to get my students to understand is that when you see a map, you can always ask why, right? Why is the map like this? Well, why does it show the extent of the world that it does show? Why is it in the colors that it is? Why does it include the things that it includes and leave out things that it leaves out? You know, and like I've been thinking about that a lot just the last couple of days being here in Chicago, because I'm, you know, navigating a unfamiliar city, so I'm using the map on my phone a lot, but I'm, you know, looking at it, trying to figure out the best way to get from one place to another, trying to figure out what things are there, you know, if I'm looking for some place to eat, for example. And as I'm doing that, I'm thinking a lot about, you know, why is Google Maps showing me things the way it's showing me, you know? Who's paying them to make that restaurant pop up bigger than the other one? And, right? And so I think, you know, if people are asking why about the maps that they see, I think that's the most important thing.
Was there a map that you had to cut from the book, or as the books have come out, that you wish you had put in there?
I mean, I could, you know, give me 15 minutes and I'll write up a table of contents for Pittsburgh and 50 more maps. You know, always so many more things that you could do, interesting maps of. Although I got lucky because as we were getting into the page layout for the book, and there's actually a little disclaimer in the front of every book in this series that says, this isn't exactly 50 maps, it just makes for a nice, you know, title. But, so, you know, if you know about how books are made, right, they have groups of pages, and, you know, they call them signatures, right? And so the book has to be a number, you know, the pages have to be in groups of signatures. You can't have just like two extra pages at the end. And so we laid it out, and you know, the maps you've given us, that leaves us with, it would be three blank pages in the book. So we can either cut one of the existing maps, or we can put the additional signature into the book, but you'll have to give us three more maps. And I was actually on a road trip at the time they sent this to me, and they're like, we need to decide within the next week. And I said, all right, when I'm in my hotel at night, I am going to do three more maps for you, because I cannot, you know, stand to cut any of the maps that I've made. I had, you know, ideas that I hadn't gotten in yet, so I'm just gonna, you know, as soon as we get to the hotel, I'm gonna pop my computer open and get you some more maps. And actually, some of the ones that I made for that, you know, those extra three were some of my favorite that ended up in the book. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to stick a few more maps in there, even though, you know, I could definitely come up with a whole lot more ideas if you gave me more pages.
That's great. I'm trying to think. I don't know if any, yet for me it was mostly like, yeah, there's a big list of ideas, you can only do so many. I just didn't have time to do them all, I guess, or some of them would have required a little too much in-depth research for what, you know, what the timeline we were trying to accomplish here. So, and then there's some others that rely on some data existing that just doesn't exist in quite a usable format. So some of these books have a map of all the buildings by their age, and that was not, I guess I could have done it for Boston, I just didn't for some reason, I don't know. We wanted to do that for Cincinnati, but the data which someone like has heroically compiled by going through all the assessor's records, it's not quite published in a usable way, but somebody has gone through and done this, but it still just has too many gaps to be easy to map out for this book, so we had to leave that out. And yeah, like, same thing. I already do have this big list of map ideas, and about half of them are checked off, but we could do like another whole edition.
Yeah, like in terms of data gaps, there's a weird one that I ran into where I was doing a map of things related to pets in the city, and I thought what would be really cool is to have the sort of the underlying base map to that be a map showing like how many people had dogs, right? Because if you have a dog, you have to get license for it, so there's like data on that in a way that there isn't data on, you know, who has a cat or whatever. And so Allegheny County, the larger county that Pittsburgh is within, has their dog license data by zip code publicly available. So I could just pull that off the website and I could map that and show, you know, for each zip code, like what percentage of people had a dog. But the city of Pittsburgh has a separate dog registration, and they didn't have that publicly available, and I called the city, and I said, you know, explained what I was doing. It's like, would you be able to send me this? And they said, well, you would have to do a Freedom of Information Act request for that, like file this legal paperwork just to get a list, you know, how many dog licenses per zip code within the city. And I was like, okay, that's too much. My wife is a lawyer and does FOIA requests for things, and they can take like a year to get back to you. And it's like, all right, that's not worth it. That would have been a really cool map to do, but the city, for whatever reason, they have so much other data that's publicly available on so many other things, but for whatever reason, dog licenses, even, you know, grouped at the zip code level, I'm not going to find out any individual person's business. They didn't want to give me, even though the county did for the people living outside the city, so I had to skip that one. Maybe if I have enough lead time on doing a second edition, I'll go that route.
So one lesson there is put your data, put your FOIA request in now, so you're ready. Do you think of something that maps, like what do you think of maps as being able to do, kind of stories that maps can tell that they can do kind of better or in different ways than something like a story or an article or even a painting or a photograph?
I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't know if it's doing something better, but it can definitely augment by a lot, like a story or a written word. You know, the picture is worth 1,000 words, a map might be worth 1,000 pictures. That's the whole purpose of maps, is to distill a very complex world down to something that you can quickly understand. And I'm just thinking of, you know, one of the things I do in my normal work is make maps for authors' books who need a map in their book that goes along with what they're writing. And I did one of those that was, the book came out a couple months ago, and I picked up the book, and I'm reading the book and thinking, I'm really glad there's maps in this book, because it's like, makes it a lot easier for me to understand. So it's a nonfiction, but it makes it a lot easier for me to understand, like, places, and the story itself is, you know, fundamentally one of geography. It's about kind of the history of the American West, to put it in short. So, I don't know, maps can definitely add like a ton of context that you would need a ton of words to try to explain, and people might still not quite get what you're talking about, I guess. So that's one thing.
Yeah, well, to riff on that, you know, making maps for books like that, you know, I had mentioned that I got into this whole map thing through Lord of the Rings, and one of my kind of hobby horses is that if you pick up a book that has a map in it, the map is part of the book. The map is part of the story. It's a mechanism by which the book is telling you the story. And I know some people that just skip the map. They're like, oh, map, I don't care about the map. I'm just going to get to the words. And, you know, I mean, everybody can read the way that they want to read. But to me, personally, that's just, like, inconceivable, because the map is part of what's telling the story. You know, Lord of the Rings would not be Lord of the Rings without the map. Right? The map tells you things about the world. It puts the characters and things are doing in context, even just things like the style of the map, right? You open Lord of the Rings, and especially if you're thinking about somebody in 1954 picking up this book before the whole fantasy genre was even a thing, right? And they flip open the book and they see that map. That map immediately tells them so much about what kind of story this is going to be, right? About the scope of the story, about the type of setting that they're in, you know, because it's done in that kind of faux medieval style. It's got all the little notes, right? You see, you know, the Lost Kingdom of Arnor, and you're like, oh, that, you know, that tells you something about what the story is going to be about. So yeah, so pay attention to the maps when they come up in books.
I'm sure no one in this room would skip the map. Maybe the other rooms. Yeah. I think we're just about a small enough group that anyone has any questions I'd like to ask. If you just ask it, I'll repeat the question so everyone can hear. So he's asking about the Homeowners Loans Corporation maps that kind of color-coded cities based on the kind of desirability of the neighborhoods, and that influenced then how loans and mortgages were given throughout the city. And he's asking if they've used these maps before.
Yeah, I very directly use that. In the DC book, we have a map that is basically that map from the 30s of, you know, the desirability of neighborhoods, overlaid with a dot density map of the current population as broken down by race. So you can very clearly see in this map that the areas that were designated, you know, where, you know, black homeowners were funneled into these areas and kept out of these areas all the way back in the 30s, still shapes the geography of who lives in what neighborhoods today.
And yeah, actually, this is one of the great things about being in this series. I think maybe almost all the books, or maybe all of them in this 50 map series, have a map based on that, those Hulk maps. The Cincinnati one, our story ended up being that nobody knows where the map is. It's missing. Like, it was almost certainly made, but nobody can find it. There's just this draft, one draft, and that's all we had to go on. So in that one, we just kind of, I think, showed it just overlaid with the modern, you know, modern map, and then I did the Boston one too, and the overlay I used there was income in the present day. Some of the areas that were rated as undesirable have since become gentrified, for lack of a better word, I guess, and are actually, there's some really high income areas of Boston that, like, in my mom's days, it's crazy for her to imagine that those are wealthy places now. But yeah, that's been, I don't know if, like, just the first book in the series, like, decided to use that, and then all the rest of us thought, yeah, we should look that up for our city too.
There's a great site from the Digital Scholarship Lab at University of Richmond that has all the extant Hulk maps to your reference for the city, so you can explore them.
Yeah, have you ever been that? You talked about Mordor, you know, that map.
So the question is, have you ever made some maps for fiction or fantasy novels?
Yeah, there have been a couple independently published authors that have hired me to do maps for their books. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, that people have tried to make maps, and that's actually been a topic that I've done, you know, since I'm a professor and I do research. One of the things I've done some research on is fan cartography, you know, how people have made maps of places. So I've got an article that I'm working on right now, for example, about the Hunger Games series. Right? So there's no map in that book, but they give you some pretty strong hints about where the different districts are. And so lots of people have tried to make their own maps. It's really interesting to see the choices that they make. When they've, all they've got to go on is like, you know, district, I forget which district is the forestry district, right? But all they know about that district is that there's a lot of logging there. And then they try to match that up with what they know about the real North America and try to figure out, well, where would that district in the book? And there's, it's some really interesting things and really interesting applications of people's understanding of geography and maps that you get when people try to make their own maps for, you know, a book that doesn't come with one.
I think we're about out of time, so my short answer is no, I'm not really creative enough, I guess, to do fictional maps, but there's a really, I think there's a very large and good, strong community of people who make especially fantasy-style maps out there.
Thank you all for coming, and let's thank our speakers.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.